Well, it's that time of the week again, where we're joined by Chef Bruce of Beau's All Natural Brewery. Hello, Chef Bruce.
Hey there, how are you, Jean?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for coming in.
Yep.
So, Chef, we're a couple of weeks into spring, and how are things looking on the food front? I'm sure you're keeping a very close eye on all the produce that's coming online as the season progresses.
Yeah, things are a little bit behind with the weather. We had a cool start, and now we're approaching drought conditions. I was listening to the weather report this morning, and they're talking about people having to start watching their well levels, and by next week, if it stays like this, they may be starting onto water restrictions and things. So that's sort of setting things back on its heels a little bit.
But feels a bit early in the season for them.
Yeah,
too,
so. It is. Yeah. We're still getting lots of beautiful asparagus. We've been doing all sorts of things with that at work. We did a salad with it, and we've got some. I was at an event last Wednesday in Toronto, and we did a strudel with asparagus and blue cheese and bacon.
I saw that strudel before I went out there.
Very, very good.
How was that received?
It was, it's hard to say this without sounding cocky, but we had one lady come back to the booth who said she'd been to the, this is the third year we've been there, and she said she came back because she'd been the previous 2 years and enjoyed our food.
All right.
And had come back the third year looking for it, was hoping we were there. So
and not disappointed, I'm sure.
No, she was very happy. So yes. That was great. Yeah, lots of other good chefs there. So it was a really nice event. It's fun to go down to Toronto once in a while. We went to the St. Lawrence Market and wandered around and had my usual pea meal on a Kaiser, and there's butchers, and you know, I can remember the first time I ever went when I was a kid, probably about 10 or 11 years old, with my uncle, and just going into this huge cavernous building with mountains of prime rib and lambs and everything else, and it was just like, wow, this is really cool.
It
and
is.
So different from a supermarket.
Yes.
You know, I wish all parents would take their children to markets, to food markets, to really see what's happening. And I also wish, and this is not going to happen, but I profoundly wish that we could sell more cheese and meat in markets, so kids could really see where it comes from.
That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah.
The fishmongers at the St. Lawrence Market, for example, you know, fish piled on big piles of
ice. It's extraordinary. Just extraordinary.
It's an amazing experience.
Now, we do need to be careful with the fish we're eating, and as usual, there's a political message in everything, but...
Yes. I checked out that website, by the way, that you mentioned.
Yeah. OceanWise.
Yes. That's quite a resource. Really
impressive. It's really great. And so, for instance, I adore monkfish. It's probably one of my favorite fish ever. Lovingly referred to as the poor man's lobster, because the flesh is so, when you cook it, it has almost the same texture as lobster, and this, it has a beautiful sweet flavor to it, and but we can't eat it anymore because it's been just so badly overfished.
We used
to eat it a lot as when I was younger, and it also makes a beautiful fish mousse, which we don't really make too much anymore because it's a little out of the way we eat now.
Yeah, but yeah, yeah.
It's interesting how much that's changed.
But monkfish has made it to the list of...
It's on the list of things you shouldn't really
eat. Shouldn't be eating, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If you just Google Vancouver Aquarium and OceanWise...
Yes, OceanWise.
It would probably take you right to the link.
That's right, yeah.
And then OceanWise has a certifying program for restaurants and
okay, excellent.
And such. But,
really impressive resource.
Yeah, it is. But we also have a lot of local fish that are great. We have things, and much maligned things like smelts. I think smelts are absolutely glorious.
They are.
If you take smelts and you soak them in buttermilk and a little bit of hot sauce for a couple hours in the fridge, and then take them out and drain them and pat them dry, and then dredge them in a little flour that you've spiced up with salt and pepper, and fry them in a hot pan so they get really crisp. You don't have to have a deep fryer, just, you know, a quarter, half inch of grapeseed oil or cold pressed canola oil.
Yeah.
And then make a really nice bright salsa verde. Which is, again, one of the first things that's coming up in the markets now is all the fresh herbs.
Yes.
So if you take your food processor and load in, you know, a half a bunch of rosemary, a half a bunch of fresh mint, about a half a bunch of Italian parsley, a jar of anchovies, three or four cloves of garlic, juice of a lemon, a schwack of mustard, and blend that all up with enough olive oil to make it sort of look like pesto. You have this really bright, shiny, glorious sauce, and just mix that about half and half with mayo and just dip the smelts in that.
That sounds fantastic.
It's, you know, we turn to things automatically. Like, we did shrimp at home on Sunday as an appetizer just for fun, and it was delicious and wonderful. But Smelts would have been just as good.
Smelts. My dad used to go fishing for smelts in Lake Ontario when I was a kid. He would come back with a bucket of them, and they were fantastic. It was so good.
And they're seasonal, too. They run at different times of the year. They're great, but you can buy them frozen, and they're not overfished, and they're not on the list, and so they're great. Another thing is farm trout. Fish farming has devils and advocates and, farm salmon where you can have problems with cross-contamination and where they can get out to sea.
Yes.
Issues like that you want to stay away from, but clothespin on-land fish farming is actually considered acceptable.
Oh, is that right? Okay, good to know.
Catfish in the southern states is a big one, and around here we have beautiful trout, like extraordinary trout.
What about local catfish? Have you ever tried local catfish? Because I know
like barbot, like the ones barbot, that they ice
that's
fish.
Right, exactly, yeah.
They're an acquired taste.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a little greasy, I think, aren't
greasy
they?
Greasy and bloody. Yeah. They're kind of... goes to the adage, you are what you eat.
Okay.
There was a...
They're bottom feeders, right?
Well, yeah. Then there was a thing floating around on Facebook yesterday about these two capybaras, I guess is how you pronounce it. They're giant guinea pigs escaped from the Toronto Zoo and ran amok in High Park. And the running thread in Facebook was, I wonder how they'd taste. And I think they would probably taste pretty horrible because you wouldn't eat them anyways. But again, I think that it's an adage of you are what you eat.
I just remember back to fishing out about a dozen balbut out of the Wye River up near Midland when I was a kid. And my grandfather showed me you had to skin them rather than... with pliers, he would peel the skin right off of them, eh? And that made a really decent meal. I really enjoyed it, actually.
Well, that's like skate.
Yeah, okay.
Skate is one of my, again, unfortunately, skate is on the endangered list, but skate was for the longest time one of my favorite fish to eat, and I think is probably in one of the top 10 dishes I've done in my life, and it was ridiculously simple, and we got some beautiful skate in, so we cleaned it, and cleaning it is very laborious. Like you say, you have to peel the skin off with pliers, and there's lots of fiddly bits that you have to get out, but you wind up with these pieces that are about the size of a small side plate. And the texture of skate is very much like the texture of flank steak. It has those broad grain to it.
Okay.
And when you fry it, so you let your butter get really dark and brown, which totally changes the flavor of the butter. So it starts to get this real overtone of nuts. It's called Bernoisette. And then you flip the skate into that so it gets all nice and brown and crusty. And then we just did a real simple tomato sauce on pasta, put the skate on top, squeezed a lemon on it, and it was... Looking at it, it seemed like the simplest thing possible, but it was extraordinary, the flavors.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it was really good.
It seems to be always the way, eh? Like the really, really simple-looking things have a lot of thought and prep maybe behind them, but the pure dish, I guess, is what shines through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's fun to put things on a plate that have lots of spices and notes to them, and you make a Moroccan tagine, or you make a dish that has many different components to it. Yeah. Those are fun sometimes, but often when you're just relying on the quality, it's sort of twofold, the quality of the ingredients and your technique, how good your technique is, and you rely on that, that's when you really get... something really beautiful.
Yeah, interesting. And you rate your skate dish as one of your top 10?
That was one of my top dishes. Wow, that was really, really good.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. What other fish? Have you heard of the folks that smoke sturgeon in Saint-Eugène?
Down in...
Le Petit Brûlé, that's right.
They're beautiful stuff.
Yes.
They're in these little pop-up local food counters they've got now. They've got one in the Metro and one in Lorignal.
Yeah, and they're often at our food festivals here on Main Street.
Yeah. They do really, really lovely stuff. The smoked sturgeon is extraordinary.
Yes.
And the caviar is really something.
Yeah.
And then with the smoked sturgeon, traditionally, and this is fun, you can make something called blini, which is a little, what you would call a silver dollar-sized pancake. That has a little bit of yeast in it to make it nice and puffy, and it's made with buckwheat flour.
Oh.
So it has a slightly sour edge to it.
Yes, and I love buckwheat, actually.
Yeah, and buckwheat flour is in Quebec. There's a lot of buckwheat flour.
Yeah.
And so you make these little blini, and then you put a little dollop of creme fraiche, and then the smoked sturgeon, and it's just a beautiful little bite.
That sounds
really,
fantastic.
Really nice.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to look into that. That sounds quite interesting.
Yeah, the blini are simple, you know.
That has sort of Yiddish roots, I think, eh? Jewish roots, the blinis? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a whole cool cuisine.
Yes, for sure.
Latkes are one of my favorite things in the world to eat.
Gefilte fish.
One of my favorite things I do, we used to call it Alsatian, but it had Jewish roots. It's called kugel, and it's like a noodle pudding, but savory.
Oh.
So you take angel hair pasta, cook it, toss it with, I used to toss it with pesto, but with some cheeses and a very light custard, and bake it in a little ramekin and then turn it out.
Mm.
And you have this little noodle as for the side of something that's kind of saucy.
That sounds really nice.
It's really delicious.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was looking at the Bo's website today under the recipes tab, which is basically your domain where you post recipes that you write
yep.
on a regular basis for Bo's All Natural Brewery. And I noticed at the very, very top, I had noticed this before, but I forgot about it, that you actually invite people to send in their cooking conundrums and little challenges and stuff.
Yeah.
Not to expect an instant response, but that over time you will get back to them. And
no, don't text me when your kitchen's on fire, because exactly. it's not going to be much help to you. But
call 911 in that case.
Well,
I think that's really interesting.
Gotten some phone calls at like 7:30 at night.
Yeah. Some real emergencies.
I'm in the middle of this. Can you help me out? And I will respond. I will do my best to respond, but I'm not always near my phone.
No.
And there is occasionally a question of sobriety, so you might not get the best response. So
that's quite an interesting, a generous offer, I was going to say.
I genuinely want people to cook from scratch. I genuinely want people to cook from the heart. And so, as a consequence, I endorse them, even if they're in the middle of a Loblaws and the recipe says, I need you to buy this ingredient and you can't find it. What is a reasonable substitute?
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be able to answer that question mm-hmm. because I would much rather have them looking for the vegetable that they can't find, or the piece of cheese, or can I substitute this fish for this fish because they don't have it today? I would love to be able to try and answer those questions, because
it encourages people to keep on going, eh? Yeah.
But I still think, and it goes to one of my theories, being in those kind of dilemmas, my theory is that most people cook backwards.
Hmm.
And that is to say that they'll take a book and they'll get the latest recipe book, which is wonderful, and they'll open it up and they'll see a wonderful recipe for halibut with asparagus and morels. That seems pretty springy. So they'll go to the market and there's no halibut and the asparagus is really scruffy and there's not a morel in sight.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
so they think to themselves, well, what the hell am I going to make now? What I think you should do is you strike up a relationship with your fishmonger, your butcher, your cheese person, and then your local farmer's market. And you go to the farmer's market and you find all these wonderful things. So you find, oh, today they had fiddleheads and they had some fresh herbs and they had wild garlic. And then you go to your butcher and he's got these beautiful, beautiful fresh chicken breasts that he got from some local place.
Yeah.
So then you go home and you open your cookbook to the index and you look up wild leeks, chicken, fiddleheads.
Work with what you got on hand.
Work with what you have. And I advocate strongly for people to have a well-stocked pantry.
Okay, yes.
So chicken stock in your freezer, tomato sauce in your freezer,
yes.
spices, you know, a big wadge of Parmesan, all sorts of things like that so that you can cook from scratch.
Yeah. So when the spirit moves you and you get inspired and you get a craving for something, you've actually got something to work with on hand.
Yeah, we all get cravings.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, I even shop for books that way. I very rarely go into a bookstore looking for a specific book. I go in, I've got $50 burning a hole in my pocket, and I
you browse.
Buy what $50 will buy.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. But if you did that for food, if you went in to see what's fresh and looking really good at the market, and you bring that home and you say, now what can I do with this? That sounds like a bit of an adventure.
Well, one of my favorite lines to go into, a fish shop, for instance, is to say, of all the fish in this market, what would you take home for dinner tonight?
Ha, that's a great question.
And the person will say, oh, I would take that home for dinner tonight, or I would take this home for dinner tonight.
And they know what's fresh and
sure
what's good.
Sure they do.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
Yep.
You could even ask a butcher that, I think. That would be a good line, too.
What would you eat for dinner tonight? He's got four beautiful steaks that he or she just cut.
Yeah.
That
he had his eye on to bring home for himself.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good tip. I like that. Well, we're approaching that moment, Bruce, where we might like to take a little musical break just to catch our breath here and come back with another fresh topic. So I thought I'd play something. I was looking for something food related, and this is a bit of a stretch, but I thought maybe the topic might be appropriate. This is going to be a local version of Mac the Knife. But,
oh, cool.
But I thought you might have some interesting things to say about knives in the kitchen when we come back.
Absolutely.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Mac eats, babe, and he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves though wears old Mackie Bay, so there's never, never a trace of red. Oh, on the sidewalk, yes, Sunday morning, don't you know, lies a body just oozing life. There's someone sneaking around the corner. Could that someone be our Mac the Knife? Oh, there's a tugboat, yeah, down by the river, don't you know, with seaman bags just drooping on down. Well, that seaman is there, it's there for waiting, babe. Five will get to ten, old Maggie's back in town. Oh, Louis Miller, well, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all of his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie spends just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Oh, Jenny Diver and Suki Daudrey, Miss Lolly Linier and old Lucy Brown. Well, the line forms on the right, babe, now that Maggie's back in town. Oh, Jenny Diver and Suki Daudrey, Miss Lolly Linier and old Lucy Brown. Well, the line forms on the right, babe, now that Maggie's back in time.
Talking about Mac the Knife, what do you think, Bruce? The whole topic of knives in the kitchen, a little bit scary for some people. I know some people that don't like the knife to be too sharp just so they don't cut themselves.
No, the knife has to be razor sharp. You will very rarely cut yourself on a very, very sharp knife.
Yeah.
You will cut yourself on a dull knife because it'll be bouncing off whatever you're trying to cook and will go sideways through your finger.
Yeah.
Because it'll still be sharp enough to cut.
Yeah.
Knives are a really interesting topic for me. I've always had nice knives. I've had good knives. In the last, I would say probably 10 years, there's been a real rise in knife fetishism among chefs. Some chefs like me will tend to buy sort of medium quality knives that work well, we can keep sharp easily, that we can use in the restaurant, and if someone accidentally opens a box or something with it, you're not going to feel like you have to use the knife on them. But there's a store in Ottawa called Knifeware, and they have extraordinary Japanese knives that are upwards of $500 and $600 and $800.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, and they're thin. See, the thing is, like, there's so many things to talk about knives, which is really interesting. One of the things is, I'm not a big fan of the German steel knives, like Henkel and Trident and knives like that, because the problem is they're made with molybdenum steel, which is fantastic if you're making a battleship that you don't want someone to be able to sink.
Right.
But for a knife, is not quite as ideal because the steel is so hard, it's very hard to get an edge back on it if you lose the edge, and it's difficult to keep sharp.
Okay.
A lot of the Japanese knives have a softer steel and a much higher carbon content in the steel.
Mm-hmm.
So you can keep them sharper, and it's easier to keep them sharp because that's the whole thing. Sharp, sharp, sharp. Because you want nice, clean cuts, and you want the knife to be sharp so that when it cuts through the fruit or vegetable or whatever, you're not leaving half of the juice on the counter and all the flavor on the counter.
That's interesting. So when it's not quite as hard as steel, you can actually probably reset it more easily with the steel?
Much more easily. And okay. The other thing is that you don't you can buy an expensive knife. It'll last you your whole life. It's wonderful. There's the sort of medium high-end Japanese knife is called a Mac, M-A-C.
Mac the knife.
A very good brand. They need to be taken care of. You need to wash them and dry them right away when you use them because they will pit because of the carbon in the steel.
Right, right.
And then you can buy knives like Victorinox has a very inexpensive line that you can buy that, again, you can keep sharp really easily. The thing is that there's two parts to it. One is what you're doing is keeping the knife with a nice long, shallow blade cutting edge to it so that when you are cutting through, say, a carrot or something hard, you're actually cutting through it. You're not splitting it like an axe. You don't want that V.
The wedge.
You want a
wedge
effect, you don't want a wedge. You're not making it. It's not an axe you're using. It's a knife.
Yes.
And so don't go to the person coming up the street with the knife sharpening truck and the bell.
Yes.
Run for the bell if it's an ice cream truck. Run away from the bell if it's a knife truck.
There's a tip.
Yeah, they do two things. They sharpen it into a V, but they also sharpen it at such a high speed and high heat that it will damage your knife.
Okay. That's not a good thing.
And please don't buy a knife set.
Hmm.
They'll probably try and give you five knives in a knife set, three of which you probably won't use. You can run the world with four knives. A good paring knife, it's called a French knife. That's the one that looks like the chopping knife.
Yes.
A good bread knife, which, believe it or not, is important, and a boning knife.
Hmm.
And I can do almost anything with that. And then if you're going to really cook a lot, the next knife I would buy would be a nice slicing knife for like slicing smoked salmon and roast beef and things like that.
Right, yeah.
But
interesting. So that's a lot less intimidating than the great big huge knife sets that you see sometimes.
Oh, man.
Over
and
the
don't
top.
Buy Cutco knives, please, for the love of heavens.
Yeah.
They're just, you can cut a penny in half, but why do you need to cut a penny
exactly,
in half?
Exactly. Getting back to sharpening for a sec, Bruce, if the guy pulling the little grindstone down the street with his bell is not the answer, where do you take your knives to get, or do you do them yourself?
Most places like Knifeware, which is on Bank Street in Ottawa.
Yep.
CA Paradis has a knife sharpening service on Bank Street in Ottawa.
Okay.
Somewhere that professionally sells knives and they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But ideally, teach yourself. Keep your eyes peeled. Many places like different cooking schools in Ottawa, Urban Element, Algonquin, run knife skills classes.
Oh.
And part of that is selecting the right knife and learning how to keep it sharp.
Yeah.
And then the rest is good knife skills. How to dice an onion properly, how to chop garlic properly.
And do it safely.
All those sorts of things safely.
Yeah. Keep your fingers out of the way.
Yeah, why you do different cuts and why you do different things.
Right,
so
right.
Keep your eyes peeled for those sorts of things because it's worth taking one.
Yeah. So these devices that you see on TV sometimes for sharpening knives and stuff, I imagine those are things to steer clear of. What's the basic of is it a stone that you would actually use?
The best way to keep a knife sharp is a couple of stones and a sharpening steel. You want a fairly coarse stone to start getting the edge back.
Right.
And then you want a fairly fine stone, usually a water stone, to refine the edge. And then a steel to just sort of touch up the edge every time you use it.
Right, right.
And then about every, depending on how much you use it, every couple of weeks or so, you should run it through the stones again.
Okay. So really basic tools to keep your knife sharp.
And
as Bruce mentioned, taking a course at one of the community colleges would be a really good idea to learn the techniques that you need to know.
Absolutely.
Like everything else, you know, it's it's doing it the right way that is really important.
Yeah. Well, it's part of the fun of becoming a young chef because there's also really proper cuts. There's a little fine dice called Brunoise, and then there's a bigger dice, and then there's batonettes, and then there's this and that and the other. How to properly dice an onion, because the important thing about cutting vegetables is that, let's say you're making a soup, you want to have all the vegetables cooking at the same time. If you've got one piece that's as big as your fist and one piece that's as big as your baby finger, this one, the fist is going to be raw while the baby finger is overcooked.
Yes.
It's important to have everything done well.
Hmm. Yeah, uniform kind of thing.
Yeah, and we've talked before about mise en place and keeping everything in its place, you know. Again, last night we made a stir fry and it just works out that my cutting board is big enough that there's three piles of vegetables on the cutting board that are organized in how long they take to cook.
Right.
So the first thing that went into the pan was the asparagus, because it takes a little longer. Then the pork went in the pan to start letting its fat go and give some flavor.
Yeah.
And then the aromatics. If I'd put the garlic in first, it would burn by the time the asparagus is cooked.
Right, right. So you got to keep in mind the time that things take.
Yeah.
And the size.
We had a little bit of a discussion, my partner and I, because I asked her to put the pan on and turn it on right away. And by the time you get everything out of the fridge and work away, then your pan is hot. But the concern was that the pan would be too hot. Well, you're moving fast enough that it's not going to get too hot. And if it does, just take it off the burner. But it was interesting.
Yeah. Getting it up to the right temperature. Yeah.
It's got to be hot.
Yes. Yeah. Really good point. Well, covering a lot of territory there. It's how to keep your knife sharp, how to cut your vegetables in a uniform way to promote even cooking. We started the show with this, Bruce, but what new produce has come online?
We've got asparagus right now and a lot of the soft herbs. I was told by one of the farmers today that he had chives, cilantro, basil, parsley, flat-leaf parsley. There's rosemary and thyme coming up, so all the herbs are coming up, which is great because you can't cook without them. The next thing along will probably be radishes will start to come along. Tokyo turnips, which are the little, they're about the size of, a little bit smaller than a golf ball. It's like a cross between a radish and a Japanese turnip.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love them in stir fries and stuff because they give a pepperiness to it. You can just slice them thinly and away to the races.
Nice, nice.
Radishes are, I think, I did a catering function once and I did, it was amazing, this lady's face. I took beautiful fresh French bread that I'd bought from a bakery, baguettes, and I buttered it with butter that I made from whipping cream with my own salt.
Mm.
And then I put three thin slices of radish and a sprinkling of really good sea salt. And that was one of the hors d'oeuvres. And this lady looked at the tray and she was like, what's the deal? They're radishes on bread. And I said, you need to try it. And then you can say that they're just radishes on bread. She took a bite. She ate four. Because it's, just, again, it goes back to that simplistic thing. Perfect bread, good butter, radishes right out of the garden that have that nice, fresh pepperiness to them.
Yes.
And the crunch of the good sea salt is so delicious. And the idea is to get your palate going and get your palate woken up for whatever the next thing coming along is, and that's what it does.
Yes, yes. And a variety of textures as well, and marriages made in heaven, it sounds like.
Or just take radishes and run them through a cheese grater.
Mm.
So you've got a big pile of grated radish, chop in a big bunch of fresh chives, including the flowers. So let's say you have a quarter cup of grated radish, about 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh chives, including the flowers, and just enough sour cream to bind it all together, and then barbecue your salmon. And just wallop that on top as a quick sauce.
Oh, nice.
And you've got the fresh peppery, the peppery radish, the cooling sour cream, the brightness of the chive,
beautiful.
The slight tang of the sour cream with the fish, which is nice and oily, and it's gorgeous. And
perfect accompaniment.
And you cook the salmon yourself at home fast, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But also don't be afraid. We're talking about fish a lot this show. We almost should have made it the fish show.
Yeah.
In our metro, in Castleman, they have these beautiful frozen fish, and I've seen them in other places too, packets in the freezer, and they're sustainable. You can get little beautiful little albacore tuna pieces. They're about 2-ounce medallions, which is gorgeous for putting on top of a salad or on top of a risotto.
Mm-hmm.
They have line-caught marlin, which is sustainable. They had one other. Anyways, and it was all frozen. And if you buy it, take it home today, thinking about tomorrow night's dinner and let it thaw slowly in the fridge.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with frozen fish like that.
Yeah, that's a good tip. That's really good. And including salmon? Can you get salmon that way? I guess you can.
You don't need to.
No.
You should be able. You can buy some of the salmon that you're going to, most of the salmon you're going to want to buy is from the West Coast because it's mostly sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Coho or sockeye. We used to get the guy phoning from the boat. He's saying, I'm coming in, how much do you want? It's like, it's so spoiled.
Wow. We're sort of landlocked here, so we don't have that luxury. But
we have other things.
Yeah, it's true. Lots of fresh water. Perch, for example, is a really big fish.
Perch is a delicious fish.
Yeah.
Just delicious.
Yeah.
Again, just dredge it in half cornstarch and half flour and salt, pepper, and hot pan butter. Nice and crispy.
Yeah. When you first started off this section saying you're really encouraging people to cook fish themselves at home, it just reminded me, I don't want to diss any restaurants, but that's one dish that I find is almost universally overcooked. And I'm not talking about the high-end restaurants. I'm just talking about the local restaurants. They don't seem to know how to cook salmon. It's always either it's left in the oven too long or something, but it's always overcooked. So I really prefer having my salmon at home. It's the only way I'll eat it.
It's very difficult to cook salmon without overcooking it. And when you're in a busy, busy kitchen, it's tough to get it out of the oven in time. And
Yeah, it's understandable that, I mean, you know, you're not necessarily going for a gourmet meal, but I think I've learned my lesson not to order the salmon at the local restaurants. If I want a really good piece of salmon, I do it myself. Let's take a little musical break. I've got a cut lined up by a local boy, Adam Davidson Harden. This is a CD that he produced partially locally. I recorded the grand piano in his mother's music room to do this track. I gave him a hand with that. And it's called Mistakes. Adam Davidson Harden and Mistakes from his most recent CD. I really, really enjoy that. Local boy, grew up here and still maintains close ties. His parents still live on Higginson Street right here in Bankleek Hill. So I think I got an email from Adam just this morning asking me if I was available to record another little bit of piano with him in the coming weeks. So I'm looking forward to that. Anyhow, Chef Bruce, we're back with more food talk.
Yes. I apologize for that impromptu break.
That's okay.
The audience won't have known, but my phone rang with its inimitable Sherwood Forest tone.
Yes.
And it was work. I had left. I'm going to be going back in a few minutes, but I had left and left a pot on the stove bubbling away. and they wanted to know if they should turn it off.
Okay.
And what it was is a, it's called a sticky chili glaze. It's kind of a Vietnamese sticky chili glaze that's really delicious for pork ribs, or this weekend we're going to do a chicken banh mi, the sort of Vietnamese style sub.
Oh,
so
nice.
You take cane sugar, white vinegar, soy, the Indonesian soy called ketchup manis, and sambal ulek, which is the chili garlic paste, and then fresh ginger and fresh garlic, and you boil that hard until it comes down to about a third of its original volume, and it gets to be like the consistency a little bit thicker than maple syrup.
Mm.
And you first you make your own Chinese five spice powder, which is really easy to do. And then you rub the thighs with that and roast them till they're almost done. Then take them out, throw them in a sticky chili sauce, and throw them either back in the oven or back on the barbecue.
Okay.
So they start to get all kind of almost burnt and crispy with this sweet, spicy deliciousness.
It sounds fantastic.
It's all the right endorphins.
But you just said it as a matter of fact, but you just, I think, revealed the secret that I've always wondered about. How do you bake or cook, roast meat with sticky sauces on it? I've always thought that you had to put it on the very beginning of the process, and
no.
It always ends up burning.
Absolutely not. No,
you,
on the barbecue or in the oven. And you have, in proper barbecue cooking, like, you know, Southern U.S. barbecue or lots of other things,
yeah,
you have what are called rubs and mops. And so the rub is the dry spice mixture that you put on the meat as it's cooking slowly. So, for instance, for Father's Day, we're going to do pulled pork.
Right.
So what you do is you take the pork shoulder and you score it deeply and you rub it all over with a paste made of garlic, whatever your spice mixture is, and a little bit of vinegar and oil.
Okay.
And rub that all over the meat and let it roast in the oven slowly, slowly, slowly till it's almost starting to fall apart. And then you rub it. It comes from when they cook big pigs and they actually use a clean one of those hand kitchen mops to mop sauce right onto the pig.
Okay.
And so you coat it with the sauce to finish the cooking.
Okay.
And that sauce starts to get really delicious and sticky and almost burnt. I did ribs at home on the weekend and I braised them in the oven to start getting them tender. Took them out, pat them dry, rubbed them with whatever. And I use smoked paprika, salt, pepper, oregano, chilies, garlic, fennel seeds, and rub them all over with that.
Yeah.
Put them on the barbecue till they're starting to really sizzle nicely. And then my sort of very quick, even weeknight go-to sauce is barbecue sauce, about a cup of barbecue sauce, a bunch of hoisin, which I love the flavor of hoisin.
Yes, me too.
Soy, again, both soys, dark soy and ketchup manis. Maple syrup, usually a splash of beer, and I whisk that all around, and then I just paint that on the meat and throw it right over the hot coals and let it get almost burnt and then take it off, and it's just so gorgeous.
But the key there is pre-cooking your meat so that you don't leave that sticky sauce on it for the whole process.
Well, that'll just burn and your meat will be uncooked.
Very good. Sambal ulek. I remember. I love that. I've always thought it was an Indonesian source.
It is. Yeah. It's great.
Because the Dutch in particular, who spent a lot of time in Indonesia, seem to have that as a part of their cuisine.
Exactly. There's a wonderful Indonesian fried rice called nasi goreng.
Yes.
Which is,
had that many times.
Delicious.
Yeah.
And I take sambal, and I take, when I have an omelet every morning for breakfast, and I take just a little bit of, I just dip my fork in the sambal jar and then beat the eggs with that.
Oh, nice.
So it's not really big heat, but it's just enough to make it interesting.
A presence, yes.
And then I have an omelet and a piece of toast and then...
Very nice. Yes. Okay, well, we're getting all sorts of insights into what Chef Bruce does in his kitchen when he goes home, either at the end of the day or first thing in the morning. Interesting insights, Bruce, and this is the ultimate test, I think, is how you choose to cook your food for yourself. Is it's going to be about flavor and taste and enjoyment rather than flash and what looks really good.
And I plan a little bit too, Jean, because for instance, let's say we're going to have a curry tonight. I'll make double the rice I'm going to need because then I have it left over in the fridge.
Then
if tomorrow I get home, I can chop up a bunch of vegetables in 10 minutes. Anybody can chop up a bunch of vegetables in 10 minutes. Do a quick stir fry, throw in the rice and whatever leftover meat you have, and you've got whatever fried rice.
That's
what we had for dinner last night. My partner Angela very patiently pulled all the pork meat off the bones from the leftover ribs, and we through that, and we had spare rib fried rice.
It was nice.
Delicious.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Yes. Once again, I haven't had supper yet, and my...
Sorry. I should bring treats.
My saliva is starting to flow here. I'm gonna have to... we're going to have to go to another cut of music if we keep this up.
Yeah.
That reminds me, you were saying about the ribs. I think we cooked that smoke hawk that I picked up at Penny's Market
I love those.
A while ago. Did it overnight in the oven at a really, really low temperature, and it just pulled off the bone the next morning. It was really, really good. We still have some in the fridge.
Use it for lots of stuff. I love summer. I love bright tomatoes, vegetables, salads. I do. But my true time for cooking is late fall and winter. That's when the dishes that I truly love to eat really come into play.
Okay.
And one of them is a French-Canadian dish called ragout de pâte et boulette. And it's stew of pork hocks. And I sort of break the law and you smoke pork hocks because I like the flavor. And then make good meatballs. And you have to make the brown flour. And there's so much... It's a very time-consuming dish to make,
but
it's basically just an excuse to eat meat-flavored gravy on really good mashed potatoes.
Yeah. You're talking to a French-Canadian boy here, so...
it's not... But if you ate it at this time of year on a day like today, you would die.
Oh, for sure.
You would fall over. Yeah. It's just...
But in the fall, you need that. It's the right kind of sustenance and...
Well, I maintain you eat all that beautiful... Creton, tartare, all those things.
They put that zone.
You line your inside with a thin layer of fat to insulate yourself against the winter.
Get you through the winter, absolutely. That's how it worked. I mean,
keeps your joints working.
Yeah, these guys worked hard. I mean, they went out, les bûcherons, you know, going out and chopping down trees. They did that in the wintertime so they could drag the trees across the
It's not something you're going to eat every day of the week. It's not something great. It's a special occasion dish. It's a Christmas dish, a Réveillon dish. And I'm not endorsing eating like that all the time. We need, like last night, our dinner had probably 10 vegetables in it of different kinds in the fried rice. We all need to combine that with activity. But if you're cutting down trees, you're burning calories.
For sure. But like you've said in the past, watching the quantities of meat that you eat as well, I mean, you know, it's a really important, I think, a cardinal rule to live by, you know?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
nowadays especially.
Yeah.
And we even go one or two meals a week where we don't eat meat at all.
Yeah.
And I have friends that do that as well, or we eat fish or whatever, but it's certainly down. We cooked a stupid amount of ribs on the weekend just because I'd bought a lot. But it's gotten... We got one meal plus the fried rice last night plus a big load of the pulled pork went in the freezer.
Yeah.
Wrapped up nicely. You have... And there was a time when I would have eaten a whole rack of ribs myself.
Yeah, yeah. But just thinking the way that you're recommending, I think you get a lot more mileage out of your meat budget for one thing, and I think you can afford to eat it maybe in a little bit more juicier ways.
Environmental thing too, and then there's the whole bit about cooking off cuts that we've talked about as well, where you're cooking a shoulder or a shank or one of those pork hocks you cook, you take the bulk of it, do something with, and then take the leftovers, and the next night you have quesadillas and salad, or, you know, it's just, there's so many things you can do with those leftovers.
Yeah. And this particular pork hock, I guess like most of them, came with the entire rind wrapped around it.
Oh, yeah.
So that went popped into the freezer, but what would you recommend doing with that?
Well, especially since that's a smoked one. Mm-hmm. So I would take and make a bean soup.
Okay.
Again, not necessarily for this time of year, but I would tie that rind up.
Yeah.
I would tie that rind up with about a quarter bunch of fresh thyme, a couple cinnamon sticks, and wrap it up really tightly with string, and just lower it into your bean soup while it's cooking, and it'll give your soup a beautiful smoky flavor.
Yes.
Without, and then you lift it out at the end, and I like to sort of, when I make bean soup, I like to take about a third of it, blend it smooth, pour it back in and give it a good stir, and it gives the soup some body.
Yes.
So it's not thin.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
But again, that sort of thing is more of a wintry food than a summer food.
Yes.
But we save all kinds of stuff like that. It brings up a really good point about like Parmesan rinds. Like you get down to the bottom of the Parmesan, chuck them in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time you make a tomato sauce, tie them up with a piece of string, lower them into the tomato sauce, and let them simmer away, and you've got Parmesan-flavored tomato sauce.
Oh, what a great idea.
Yep.
That's a great idea. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, good point. I was going to say, getting back to the cooking in the fall, I mean, we are in the spring now, so we don't want to spend too much time on fall cooking, but it was a part of the whole routine of I guess, you know, slaughtering the animals in the fall when the weather is cooler.
That's so right.
You've got more time to handle
precisely
the meat and that kind of thing. And all of those things, bringing in the harvest and putting, you know, salting things and fermenting things.
Yeah, curing and preserving and pickling mm-hmm. thing. I'm probably going to pickle a whole bunch of asparagus for the next little while, and I'm doing recipes for asparagus right now for something, and one of them is going to be pickled asparagus.
Hmm. And is that an actual fermented pickle, or is it a vinegar?
It's not fermented; it's a vinegar pickle.
Okay, yeah, interesting. I'm really exploring fermented dills and that kind of thing these
yeah,
days.
Yeah, in this case, it wouldn't really.
It'll be
a white vinegar and water brine.
Okay,
probably some herbs, tablespoon of pickling spice, a couple garlic cloves.
Yeah. I've always been curious, does brining meat as a cooking technique come from, like, from preserving things, or is that kind of separate? Like, when you brine a chicken or a, you know, whatever, is that a holdover from the preservation brining?
It's half and half. There is a preservation value to it.
Okay.
Especially with things like salt beef,
mm-hmm.
Salt pork, those pork cottage rolls you can buy in the store.
Yes.
That's sort of the one end of it, but the end we're doing now is a much less salty brine and much more
for flavor.
Much more for flavor. You have the whole, if you want to talk to like the science of it, is basically osmosis, if you remember grade 10 chemistry.
Yes.
And cellular biology, where you have, you know, the salt is looking to create balance, and so the water goes into the meat, pulls the salt in, and it just everything comes into balance. And then you flavor the meat from the inside out and keep it moist while it's cooking.
So I've read somewhere that you're not actually adding salt to the meat, that you're actually changing the balance of the
precisely
within
yeah.
the meat, right? Yeah, it's quite interesting. I love brined turkey or brined chicken. I mean, it just
that's the only way to
so
go.
Much. It's amazing.
The only chicken breast we ever served in my restaurant was brined.
Really, eh?
Because otherwise it was just not... There was no flavor.
We have just a few minutes left before the end of the show, Bruce. Would you mm-hmm. be willing to just go over the basic steps of brining chicken?
Okay,
chicken breast?
So you're going to brine, let's say you're going to do 6 chicken breasts on the barbecue for Saturday.
Right.
There's a few important things to do. So first of all, there's 2 ways to make the brine. One is to make the brine on, so you want to brine overnight. So you're going to brine from Friday to Saturday. But the brine is very, very important, and I'll talk more to this in a minute, that the brine be fridge cold and the meat be fridge cold. So in order for your brine to be fridge cold, you can do 2 things. You make it Thursday, let it cool, wrap mm-hmm. it, put it in the fridge overnight. Friday, brine your chicken.
Yeah.
Or if on Friday you don't have time, and this advocates that everybody should own a kitchen scale, you take your brine, and let's say you need 750 mils of brine, you then take 750 grams of ice, bring your brine to a boil, dump in the ice, it will immediately cool the brine,
yes.
and then you can put it over the meat.
Bring it down.
So that's
cool.
And you would compensate for that in your recipe.
And what percentage of salt, and do you use sugar in your brine as well? Or do you just...
It depends what I'm brining.
Okay.
Mine are mostly straight salt.
Yes.
And I also often, instead of water, I use different, well, 99.9% of the time I use beer.
Yes, yes, because, I've heard you say that before.
And different flavored beers, because it's just a great thing to do. But I also yep. use apple cider, orange juice, okay. all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So for 2 liters of water or liquid, I would do about 1/4 cup of salt.
Okay. Okay. That gives
it's not a lot.
The proportion. No.
It's not a lot.
No, I thought it would have been more.
No, and that gives it a really nice little pump. And then you put the cold brine onto the cold meat, let it sit overnight. The next day you take it out, pat it dry, and proceed as you would.
Right.
If you put warm brine on the warm meat, there's 2 things that might happen. Mm. If it's too hot, it'll actually cook the meat.
Yeah.
But the other problem is,
which
you don't want, because you'll wreck the texture of it.
Yeah.
But the other thing you don't want is if you put the warm brine on the meat, it will sit in what's called the danger zone too long,
mm-hmm.
which is between about 120, 160 degrees. And that's just where the little bacteria are just having a grand old time. They're
right.
in the pool just having a party,
okay.
and you
yeah.
don't want that.
No. So that's why it's so important to make sure your brine is really,
precisely.
Really cold.
Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually let it sit in the fridge overnight kind of
and
thing.
And then you put aromatics in your brine. So, you know, usually depending on where you're going, there's almost always garlic, herbs, bay leaves, could be juniper berries, could be pickling spice, could be who knows what, depending on what you're brining.
Yes, yes.
If I'm, you know, I'll often make a brine for a chicken in the summer that has whole lemons sliced into it. Lots of fresh lemons, and then you serve that with a tzatziki or something after it comes off the barbecue, like that sort of thing. So
Very, very good. Yeah, well, that's good. That's one of the, I think, one of the most magical ways of enhancing the flavor of white meat in particular, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. It's like alchemy, you know?
Yes, exactly.
It's great.
Yeah. Well, with that little insight into brining, Bruce, I think we've brought ourselves up to very close to the end of the show.
Awesome.
I hear a little bit of the theme music in the background there.
Yep.
Just a reminder to people that this is the theme music from the food-focused Hollywood movie, The Big Night. That was the reason why we decided, I decided to go with this music. It just evokes for me anyway a steaming kitchen with fantastic flavors coming out and a couple of guys that are just oohing and aahing about over the wonderful dishes that they're creating, and it just evokes food to me. So and I think Bruce, you said that's one of your favorite movies.
We should talk about food movies on another show.
Yeah, it might be fun. In fact, I'm hoping that you'll come back maybe next week with a couple of music titles of songs that you would like to hear on the show, and we'll and maybe invite our listeners as well to share with us food-related songs that
and come up with a name for the show.
Exactly. Yeah, I got a couple of suggestions recently, but I'm not going to put them on the air until we get a few more suggestions, and then maybe we'll have a discussion of them on an upcoming show. Anyway,
excellent.
Thanks, Bruce, for joining us this week.
We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah. Bye.